So maybe get started. So last time we introduced this kind of formula where we take an integral maybe this is a 1 over h bar times some function of x. And this was the same as e to the h bar, where I build a second order differential operator in the propagator, and I apply that to the same function. New value at x equals 0. So for today's discussion, I realized there's a slight generalization of this. And of course, this is just a nice way of rewriting the Feynman diagram expansion, because this second order differential operator is the thing that contracts edges in the graph. So applying this operator a bunch of times to the vertices, each of which has a copy of f, is building up the Feynman diagram. So a slight variation of this . What if I do this integral where in this function I evaluated f of x plus y and I'm integrating against x? So I'm left with some function of y. And the answer is it's just the same thing, except I don't restrict to this variable being 0. So I apply this operator to this exponentiated function, and I don't evaluate at any special point. And this is equal to some sum over graphs with external legs. Exactly as before. And on the internal lines, we put the propagator. And on the external, we label the external legs by this variable y. OK, so we're going to be using this today. So of course, well, this doesn't work. But I want to try to evaluate some simple path integrals. And we'll run into the phenomenon of UV divergences. So now consider, you're going to have my fundamental field will be a function on Rn. And I'll have the usual kinetic term. Phi plus phi zero cubed. So by what we just discussed, this is going to be sum over connective diagrams. With external lines, with the factor of h bar to the number of loops, which is the first Betti number, and then there'll be some amplitude for the graph, which will be a function of phi zero. So to figure out, to get a feeling for this, these expressions, let's just write down the first couple of terms. So, yeah.
The automorphisms, I think I last time, but it was maybe a different, slightly different situation. The automorphisms, are they allowed to move the external legs?
Yes, they are. Like having that normalization of 1 over 3 factorial helps you get the right automorphism factors when they move the external legs. So we'll see. So let's compute, first look at the H-mark of the zero terms. The first one we find is this, where I haven't contracted any edges. So what's that? That's just going to be the thing I stuck in there in the first place. So this will be 1 over 3 factorial integral phi 0 cubed. Because I haven't contracted anything. And you see the 1 over 3 factorial is the automorphism factor. The next one So here, I have two vertices. Here I have one vertex, so there's only a single integral. Because if we look in the interacting term, it involves an integral. So for every vertex, we're going to have an integral over spacetime, which is Rn. So here I have one vertex, so it's one integral. Here, I'll have some automorphism factor. We're going to have an integral, a double integral over x1, x2 in Rn. So the rules are going to be, for each external line, I just put in phi 0 at either x1 or x2, depending on whether this external line is connected to that vertex or this vertex. So here I'll get phi 0 x1 squared, phi 0 x2 squared. And for the internal line, I'm going to put down, write down the propagator. And I'm going to have an automorphism factor. So how many automorphisms does this diagram have? There's, I can flip there, that's 2. Flip there, that's another 2. Flip there, so it's 8. Yeah?
What's it maybe a number of loops minus 1?
Well, there's a h-bar in front of the log.
Oh, sorry.
Take shift. And of course, the propagator is I'm terrible at remembering factors of pi. The propagator looks like this. Yeah. Now, you can see, if you can, of course, continue writing these expressions, and you'll see that all of the integrals you'll write down, as long as you know the dimension of your space is not too small, all of the integrals will converge. There won't be you know, it looks like the integrand has a pole when x1 is equal to x2, but actually it's still absolutely convergent over there. The reason being, if you think about, you know, to analyze the convergence, we might say, we might as well take these guys to be constant, because that's not going to, these things, these are smooth functions, they'll make things converge more, they can't make things converge less. So the worst case scenario is when they're constant. So to figure out the convergence of this, you want to think about the integral over of radius 1 over R n minus 2 times the volume of the n minus 1 sphere. And the volume of the n minus 1 sphere is big enough to make, or small enough as R goes to 0 to make this converge. Because this is like so in a similar way, any diagram involving trees will give you something that's convergent when the points are close together. If you're in small dimensions, you might run into problems when the points are very far apart. Those are called IOR divergences. We're not going to be too concerned with these IOR divergences. In big enough dimensions, when things are far enough apart, this is going to decay nicely. Now, to avoid the IOR divergences, it helps to assume that the functions you're putting in, this phi zero, decays rapidly at infinity. So let's move on to look at the one loop term. So the first two diagrams one encounters look like this. So this one is just a disaster. This is going to be the integral. Now there's one vertex, because so there's one thing we're integrating over. Phi zero of x, this one is the propagator at when, well, at x minus x. So this term just makes no sense. Because you're evaluating something like 1 over the absolute value of x at 0. Well, then we can also look at the next term, and we'll find something that looks a little more sensible, but actually is divergent. And of course, there's some automorphism factors which you guys can figure out. So here we have two propagators. So we actually, that means we just take the square of the ordinary propagator. So that's going to be minus x2 to 2n minus 4. So again, like following the same argument, like to analyze whether this is going to converge or diverge, we can just use dimensional analysis, just like we did over there. So the UV divergences are what happens when these guys are close together. So we don't really care about the integral over x1 plus xt. So you might as well just focus on the difference between them. And we can set these to be a constant, just to analyze singularities. So if we look at y equals x1 minus x2, we're looking at some kind of integral over 1 over y, 2n minus 4, dny. And this is dimension n. This is dimension 4 minus 2n. Typically, this will be of negative dimension and therefore diverge. It'll look like some integral of by dimensional analysis, the integral of or d or, and you want this whole thing to have dimension let's see, this is 4 minus 2n plus n. You want this whole thing to have dimension 4 minus n, so this should be this kind of thing. So typically, this will diverge. Okay, so this leads us to our first. So we've seen that UV divergences occur at one loop in like the very simplest Feynman diagrams. So we want to understand how to regularize them and to remove the singularities. So to do that, we're going to need to pick something called some kind of regularization scheme. And there's a number of different choices. I see. Are there any questions? So a popular option is dimensional regularization. I kind of hate dimensional regularization. I think it's kind of silly to pretend that your space is of dimension n minus epsilon because, you know, you have a tensor with n components. It doesn't make sense to say it is n minus epsilon components. Another issue with it is that this doesn't really make sense on arbitrary manifolds. And you often want to study quantum field theory on a general manifold. So another way approach that I think is quite useful is point splitting. So what that would amount to here is you would look at this integral and you would say, well, the problems occur when x1 is equal to x2, so let's only look at the integral over the region where x1 and x2 are separated by a finite distance. So then we've introduced a regularizing parameter, epsilon, and then you would study the epsilon to zero limit in the singular terms and subtract them off. So this has been studied. There's some nice work by Epstein and Glaser in the 70s. One disadvantage of this approach is that it's a bit tricky to make sense of tadpole diagrams like this. There's only one point. How do you split it? It's a bit difficult. It's kind of hard to be systematic about such things. But people do, but it's not. That part of it always feels a little ad hoc. So what we're going to use is a method based on the heat kernel. So I like this because this has a nice physical interpretation. I find it easy to work with. So here the idea is you write propagator as an integral of a quantity called a heat kernel, or, and then we have a regularized propagator. To be the same thing where I just restrict the domain of integration. And it turns out that the heat kernel is a nice smooth function except at t equals zero, so that this, once I regularize this way by bounding below the domain of integration of t, so all Feynman diagrams, these have no singularities. Like the integrals we do to compute the weight of the Feynman diagram, these have no singularities when we use this propagator. And then we will study what happens when epsilon goes to zero and extracting the terms which are singular in epsilon. So to explain this, I need to tell you what KT is. It's a really fun object of mathematics and physics. We have a manifold. This is the Laplacian. And I'm going to use the convention that the Laplacian has positive spectrum. The heat kernel, KT, XX prime, it's a function, smooth function,
assuming M is compact.
If M is not compact, then there's more than one heat kernel. But if M is compact, yeah. So I was going to get to that point in a second. It's a smooth function on M plus M. Let's say a heat kernel, which satisfies dt plus del x. Yes, it's the Hodge Laplacian acting on functions, but the one with the usual, it's the one that's dt star. So it's like with the convention, so it has positive definite. There's no eigenvalues are non-negative. So on flat space, on flat space, or n, there's a unique kt with nice asymptotic behavior. And it's given by the formula kt x x prime. Oh, I forgot to put the initial conditions. So this differential equation tells you the evolution in time and the limit as t goes to zero of kt x prime is a delta function at x equals x prime. So on flat space, it looks like t to the minus n over 2 e to the minus x prime squared over t up to factors of pi. So if you look at this expression, you notice it has nice exponential decay. And the rate of decay is governed by t. Very pro. Davide is not allowed to come to this course. Thank you. Okay, so what's the physical interpretation of this? This is something discovered in the 19th century. Oh, actually, let me come back to that in a minute. So if M is a compact manifold, then there exists unique kernel. And if M is not compact, well, you have to worry about boundary condition. There, if it's not compact, there exists a heat kernel, but it's not unique. Yeah, just because this differential equation might have some different boundary conditions, and it's not so important. So we write down one more formula. You might ask, what is the heat kernel for the circle? Turns out the heat kernel for the circle has a very nice formula. With the coordinate theta, and theta plus 2 pi is theta, then the heat kernel, theta, theta prime, is t minus a half times the sum over the integers. E to the minus theta prime plus 2 pi n. So what have we done? We've taken the heat kernel for the real line, we've averaged it to make it periodic. That gives you the heat kernel for the circle. Similarly, the heat kernel for manifolds which have a covering space, which is flat space, are all obtained in this way. On the other hand, if you wanted to write down the heat kernel for like some random metric, you know, you have no chance. Okay, so I'm going to come back in a minute to the how to construct the propagator from the heat kernel. But first, I want to explain the physical interpretation of the heat kernel. So we note that there's a couple of them. Firstly, kt x x prime is equal to the probability distribution for a Brownian particle. Which at t equals 0 is at x. So we start t equals 0, we put in a Brownian particle which is moving around by jiggling, and then after time t, it's going to be somewhere on the manifold with some probability, and this is the probability. So it's kind of fun to think about why that's the case. Like, why does a differential equation tell us it must be the probability of a Brownian particle? Well, you should think about, well, the probability amplitude, you know, the probability distribution for a Brownian particle, of course, satisfies a differential equation. It just tells you what's the, I have a Brownian particle there, what's the probability it's somewhere nearby after some small amount of time. And the probability is going to be uniform in that sphere. On flat space, on a curved manifold, it will be deformed. And you can convince yourself that the probability after a small amount of time is obtained by applying the Laplacian to the probability we had originally. Just because it, you know, if it was a lattice, you can imagine summing over the second derivative in the various directions. Second interpretation. This is an interpretation, you know, we are very familiar with. We come into a cold room, we turn on a radiator. For some finite amount of time, what is the distribution of heat? It's given by the heat kernel. So, is equal to the heat at x prime if at t equals 0, we have a point source of heat. At x. Of course, this is kind of the same thing because heat is like particles moving around. And the third one, okay, it, if we imagine allowing ourselves to analytically continue, we could look over the heat equation and notice that if we stick an I in, it's the Schrodinger equation. So kit, xx prime, is equal to the wave function for a quantum particle at t equals 0 is at x. Okay, so three and these two guys are really the same, because if we kind of quick rotate a quantum particle, we're supposed to, you know, kind of find a Brownian particle. This is the path integral interpretation of quantum mechanics. It's a randomly moving, it's like a particle randomly moving on your manifold. Okay, any questions? Okay, so why can we get the propagator from the heat kernel? So let's think for a moment about a massive field theory, which makes life a little easier. If you consider, if our kinetic term is phi Laplacian plus m squared phi, then the propagator satisfies Laplacian on one variable plus m squared p x x prime is equal to a delta function. So I claim that we can write this guy as an integral of the heat kernel. So to check this, we're going to check that the differential equation holds. So we'll look at the Laplacian on one variable plus m squared times this integral. So we can bring this guy inside the integral. We get two terms, m squared e to the minus m squared t, kt, x, x prime. And applying the Laplacian to the heat kernel picks up the factor of minus d by dt. So now we integrate by parts. And well, how does that work? We can move this over here at the price of a change sign and also at the price of introducing some boundary terms. So if we move this over there, we'll get, probably go up to the other blackboard. M squared plus del t e to the minus m squared t a t. And then that's what we get from moving the del t to the other side. Then we're also going to get boundary terms plus there's a term for t equals zero. When t is equal to zero, of course, this term becomes one. So you get the heat kernel zero. And when t is equal to infinity, this is exponential decay. So that doesn't count. We get nothing. And this term, of course, cancels. And this term is equal to a delta function. Okay, any questions? So, okay, so you might ask, why do we want to use the massive particle? And the answer is that if you're in a field theory, if you're in a massless field theory, it's hard to write down. If you're in a massless field theory with some zero modes on a manifold, there really isn't a propagator anymore. Because you can't integrate out the massless modes, you can only integrate out the massive piece. So you'll find it's not possible to find something which will satisfy the analog of this equation with m is zero. Instead, you will always pick up a boundary term from infinity, which will be the projection onto the harmonic fields. The massless case. We find the Laplacian x times the integral k t x x prime is equal to the delta function x prime plus the harmonic representative of the delta function. So, this is a bit of a kind of subtle point. So what we're going to do for a massless field theory is we say, well, we can't actually find a propagator which satisfies just this equation with just the delta function. This thing here will be good enough. This is the thing. You know, if we just throw away the zero modes, this will be what we want. Now on Rn, things are okay even in the massless case because you can put boundary conditions to ensure there are no zero modes. On Rn, it's easy to see that the integral of t minus n over 2 e to minus x prime squared over t dt. So just by dimensional analysis, this is like up to some factor, the propagator. I mean, this by some simple dimensional analysis, every copy of t contributes a factor of the norm of x minus x prime, and a norm of x minus x prime squared, and you know there's 1 minus n over 2 copies of t. Okay, so in what follows, I'm going to kind of ignore this subtlety here and just say, like, my propagator will be defined to be this integral. So let's go back to the phi cube theory on Rn and see what writing things in terms of the heat kernel does for us. So this expression so it's going to be sum over connected graphs but what we're going to do is say the propagator is now an integral so for each graph we're going to introduce a parameter for each edge. And integral So I'm going to integrate over these parameters. And then there's some weight of the graph. In this case, kt1, kt2, where I put the heat kernel at time t, te on the edge e. And then 1 over the automorphism group of the graph. So I'm putting it like this because there's a really beautiful interpretation of this expansion. So when we have, if you remember, the heat kernel here tells you about the probability of a Brownian particle going from here to here in time t1. And here, we also have probabilities of Brownian particles going from there to there. These probabilities are given by integrals over the space of maps from this interval to the manifold. Because if you look at the whirl line of a Brownian particle, the amplitude of a Brownian particle is the integral, as a path integral over that whirl line. So this is the same thing as a sum over graphs, gamma, of an integral of the space of metrics on the graph, And then this weight, the amplitude of the Feynman diagram, is now a path integral. Integral of the space of maps, gamma to my manifold, say Rn, of some kind of Lagrangian. So we really are summing over possibilities of particles colliding and interacting with each other. I mean, in a completely literal sense. Like in Euclidean signature, these are literally Brownian particles moving around. The only strange thing is that each edge of the graph has its own time. This is called a proper time of a particle. So we're integrating over the proper time. So I think this picture is due to Feynman. Though I don't think he used the language of the heat kernel, but. So another reason this picture is important is that this is exactly what happens in string theory. This is the field theory limit of the way string theory presents you amplitudes. So let me briefly say about that. In string theory, well, here. So one thing to notice is that, you know, we're summing over graphs and integrating over the space of metrics. You can, if you want, think about the space of all graphs with a metric being connected or has a bunch of components, but the only component is given by how many loops it has. So at each loop, the space of possible graphs is connected because I can contract some edges and expand off others. So at each loop, this can be rewritten as an integral over some compact space. And that's what happens in string theory. So we have sum over the genus integral of the moduli space. The moduli space of graphs is the moduli space. The moduli space of surfaces is the moduli space of conformal structures. Just like this is the space of metrics. Then integral of the space of maps from the surface to the target manifold. That's exactly the same thing. And in some limit, it's expected that this becomes this. Yeah.
Is that an amplitude in some quantum mechanics or
this one here? It's quantum mechanics, but on this singular one manifold.
Now, I'm just trying to ask you the distinction between amplitude and problem.
Well, I'm working in Euclidean signature mostly, so then it would be it's more like a Brownian probability. But if we were to work in Lorentzian signature, there would be factors of I, which would make it a probability amplitude. So like the heat kernel itself is an amplitude for quantum mechanics. So that.
Is there a physical interpretation for why vertices mean? Why you allow particles to
be well, I think the best interpretation is to say that the contribution from each graph will be given by the amplitudes from some kind of a quantum field theory on this singular one-dimensional space. And the contributions of the vertices, I mean, to say what the theory that lives in the singular one-dimensional space is, I have to say, well, what happens over here and what happens over here? Because they're different. And that's you know, the vertices just tell me what happens. That's why string theory is nice, because all the points are the same. Yeah.
So could you comment on how well this regularization works on general Lorentzian manifolds? Is it not just Rn with recursion?
Off the top of my head, I don't know much about the analytical issues of the heat kernel on a general Lorentzian manifold. Maybe the thing to do there would be to take this T to be imaginary, and then you're looking at literally quantum mechanics. I'm not entirely sure. Okay, any other questions?
In the finite dimensional setting, is this all the same in this notion of a finite dimensional heat kernel and so forth, like lattice heat kernels?
Yeah, I suppose you would replace like your manifold by a finite set of points, probably. And then like each edge goes to one point. Like the points would be, you know, you have some, the kinetic term gives you some matrix which you diagonalize, it gives you the endpoints. So then each edge goes to some point, but the vertices might mix different points, something like that. Okay. So how can we? This is fun. So how can we, you know, concretely understand the singularities in Feynman diagrams? So let's again look at this pi cube theory on Rn, and let's analyze what happens for the first couple of Feynman diagrams we found that were badly behaved. So what does this diagram do? There's going to be some factor of t which we want to integrate over. This will give me the integral over x in Rn, phi 0 of x, then the heat kernel at x. Now if you remember the heat kernel, on flat space, it only depended on the difference between the two variables. So there was a prefactor t minus n over 2. So to understand the actual amplitude, we're going to have to integrate over t. But I'm going to integrate over t equals epsilon to infinity by introducing a UV regulator at epsilon. We get but clearly dimension 2 is going to be badly behaved here. So let's work, for the moment, let's take a dimension not 2, or bigger than 2. So what we've done is we've seen that there's some like when we perform the integral, now we have some control over the singularities that appear, whereas before we just said, well, we have to evaluate this function when x equals x prime, that just doesn't make sense. So to deal with this, we will proceed by introducing a counter term, and this will be the counter term. So I'll discuss more about that next time. This will be the counter term, and when n is equal to 2. When n is equal to 2, you note that this is like t minus 1 dt. It doesn't decay rapidly enough at t equals infinity for the integral to converge. So we have to introduce an IR cutoff and a UV cutoff. So when n equals 2, we're going to integrate from epsilon to L t minus 1 integral x phi 0 x. This will be something like log L minus log epsilon. And we will introduce this counter term here. Just the one which depends on the UV cutoff. So I maybe for the mathematicians in the audience, this is not what's going on, it's not clear, but I'll be some more systematic about what I mean by counterterms next time. For now, I just want to just write down a couple of integrals so we get a feel for things. So the next example, so this was an example we saw that gave us a divergent integral last time. But here, this is going to lead to an integral from T1 equals epsilon to infinity. Both T1 and T2 go from epsilon to infinity. X1, X2, phi 0 of X1. Phi 0 of x2. Now we're going to plug in the heat kernel. T1 minus n over 2, T2 minus n over 2. And then we're going to have this expression here. So this is a little complicated. But what you can do, and what we'll discuss next time, well, you can notice that this, you know, as long as these t's are not too small, this integral converges beautifully. Because of this, we've replaced 1 over x1 minus x2 to some power by this Gaussian. What you can also notice is that if when I integrate over x1 minus x2, I'm doing a Gaussian integral. We know how to do Gaussian integrals. They're given by Feynman diagrams, by Wick's lemma. So this integral, as long as this factor here is small, can be expanded by using Wick's lemma. In that way, you'll find an expansion in terms of all of the singular terms will be some finite number of terms in the expansion given by Wick's lemma, plus something which converges nicely. And this way, you can find out what is the singular part of this integral and what are the counterterms. So I think we'll talk a little bit more about this next time. I suppose the main thing I wanted to explain today is like how to regularize to make things finite.